This is the session called Inside High-Tech Culture, How to Belong Without Giving Up Your Values. If you're in the wrong place, now's the time to leave. Okay, my name is Karen Rapp. I'm with Freescale Semiconductor here in Austin, and we're a sponsor of today's event. And I am really pleased to be here and have the opportunity to introduce this panel and our host today. Freescale's done a lot recently to get involved in STEM education and supporting the inclusion of women in everything that we do in those fields. And so it's really a pleasure to be able to be here and be a part of this discussion. So I'm going to introduce our host today. Kathy Brabson is from Time Warner Cable. She's been there for a long time and has had the opportunity to touch jobs at every level within the organization. She's now the regional vice president for the Central Texas Division. And if you're here in Austin, you probably know Time Warner Cable pretty well. So Kathy's had the chance to talk to people at all levels in the organization, and she's got the experience to be able to share that with the panel today and bring some really good questions to this. So I'm pleased you're here, and welcome to Kathy and the panel, and we'll go ahead and get started. Thank you.
Good morning. I will tell you right now that I am in denial, and I have printed out my questions in really big font, but I do bring my glasses just in case, so I am in denial of needing those just yet. So technology and innovation plays a huge role in our economy, our society, everywhere today, yet men continue to dominate this field. So I think our discussion today is twofold. One, how do we get our young girls to love math and science? And two, how do we get the young women who find a place in that world to reach their full potential? At age six, I've heard Debbie say this, at age six, most girls or some girls start to lose their interest in math and science. If you talk to girls who go into programming classes or robotics classes, you will hear the same thing over and over. Isolation. They were the only girl in the class, and they were told this class is for boys. Only boys do computer programming. It's too hard for girls. So, Debbie, you've been on the forefront of introducing young girls to loving math and science. Would you have some advice for parents, moms and dads of young girls, to keep them focused on this love?
You know, for girls, there's a real challenge because I think such an important part of it is having great role models. And parents can be great role models. The challenge is there are so few female engineers, period, that there just aren't that many out there to be role models for these little girls. And a lot of parents, my mother actually was very intimidated by engineering herself. And I remember when I first told her I was going to major in engineering in college, she said, "Ew, why?" So I think one thing that parents can do is actually embrace engineering and technology themselves and try not to be intimidated by it. I recently came across this fascinating study that shows how little girls start to develop this horrible thing called math anxiety. And one of the primary reasons why they begin to become afraid of math is because their mothers are afraid of math or their female teachers are afraid of math. And boys don't suffer from this the way that girls do. But when they see kind of an adult role model figure shy away from these things, they shy away too, and it trickles downward. So one thing I would really recommend to any parents in the room is to be open-minded about it. And with Goldieblocks, we're trying to show how engineering can actually be really fun, and it's about problem solving, and it doesn't have to be intimidating, and we're bringing in humor, and we're making it accessible, and showing how it can help people and make the world a better place. And I really encourage parents to kind of start learning with their kids. I think that that's really the best way because kids really look up to their parents.
Kind of leading into what you said about there's not enough women engineers in the field, women working in science, engineering, and the tech field are 45% more likely than their male peers to leave in the first year. And they cite three reasons that they leave. A sense of isolation, biased evaluations, and lack of women mentors. And under the lack of women mentors, Josh Lynn Goldfein, director of engineering at Facebook, said, the reason there aren't more women computer scientists is because there aren't more women computer scientists. So that kind of leads into what you said. So what do you guys think about that? Kimberly, what do you think about that? The reason there aren't more women computer scientists is because there aren't more women computer scientists.
I definitely agree with that. I think there's often in the industry, or at least the feminist tech industry, a bit of debate about what comes first. Do we need more women in the field first to get more women? It's a little bit of the chicken or the egg, and I think it's a little bit of both because we have leaks all along the pipeline. So I'm a staunch believer that we do have a pipeline program issue, and that we need more women going into the field, like starting out from age 7 or 6 or even younger, that are really having an interest in computer science and sticking with it. But we need those women to stay in the game. So we need those women to get through high school and still be interested in tech, which often doesn't happen. We need those women to leave high school and go to college, where the numbers of graduating computer scientists is less than 18% of women. We need those women to graduate with those degrees and then go back and work at these companies at Facebook and Twitters and Googles. And we need them to be able to rise through the ranks and then eventually leave those ranks and start companies of their own. So I just talked about all the different places in the pipeline. We have leaks in every single place. There's not one place where the pipeline is doing well. So all those things point to the fact that we need women to be in, we need women to stay in, and having women that can reach down and help each different phase and be mentors through women along the way is the key to making that a possibility.
And I think that also speaks to the sense of isolation, that mm-hmm. feeds into the sense of isolation, walking into a room, being the only person, the only woman in the room. Renee, so talk to us about having a sense of isolation in some circumstances you've been in.
So I've been in the tech field for over 20 years, and I think that the number, starting out, it was probably close to 50-50, male, female, in an engineering company. And over those 20 years, I've seen that dwindle, particularly in my peer group, as I've moved up through the organization as women have off-boarded for any variety of reasons. It doesn't make me particularly uncomfortable and isolated. I was talking to somebody today, and it took me 2 days at a staff meeting to notice that out of 35 people in the room, I was the only woman. And it was 2 days in before that really, and I was trying to think specifically about what clicked in my mind to make me notice that, and I couldn't come up with it, but I surveyed the room, and I was one of 35. And I don't notice it on a regular basis anymore. But what I did notice a few years back was that while not uncomfortable and isolated in the workplace, I found that my circle of friends was very male-dominated because that's where I spend my life, is in my job and at work. And I was lacking female friendship because there's just not that many in the company to reach out to and develop those relationships. And so I solved that problem for myself by going out and getting involved in the community and joining women's organizations and trying to find other outlets, for that need for female companionship.
Okay.
I wanted to just piggyback on that because I think it brings up an interesting insight. So I spent, I graduated with a degree in electrical engineering and spent all my career in heavy industry. And being both a woman and a woman of color, it was extremely isolating, especially when I first started. So I think what happens is that over the years, because you get used to it. So, I would have those experiences too, and being in a conference room full of men and, just going about what we do as women with being professional and doing our job. But it's because we've been, something happens in our mind. We get used to the fact that we're the only one in the room. But for young women, they don't. And that's where we lose them. because you sent a college student. That was me. I was a college student. I graduated and went right to work for DuPont, and I was supervising men that could be my grandfather. Really? Well, it was great that they had that much confidence in me. It was extremely difficult. That was a difficult five-year period because I didn't have any role models. I didn't have any peers. And I was expected, a 20-year-old expected to lead men that were 50 and close to retirement age. And I think for young women, if we really want them to be able to go into these male-dominated fields, we have to change it so it's not male-dominated, but we also have to reach back. Even though we've gotten to those middle management and above positions, and reach down and be those mentors and be those sponsors for those young women, because those are the ones that we're losing and make it, you know, this whole scenario start again.
Yeah, so Aaron Teague, Director of Product Management at Yahoo, says that in almost every working group she's been the only black woman in the room. But she, kind of to what you said, Kimberly, she says, You have a unique voice in the room, and that you have to find your voice and use it. So, Debbie, can you talk about finding your voice and using it?
Yeah, you know, I was one of very few women in my classes, in my engineering classes in college. And when I started Goldieblocks, I was one of very few women in entrepreneurship. And Goldieblocks is based in Silicon Valley, and I was constantly being invited to these tech gatherings with other founders, and they were almost all these young guys. And a lot of times people would go out of their way to tell me that I was invited because they needed more women there, which is really insulting. And the vibe that I found, I know that there's this term called brogrammer, and there's this vibe that I've noticed now in my classes at Stanford and in kind of my peer groups now in entrepreneurship in Silicon Valley. There is, it's hard to describe it, it's this sort of elitist, kind of extremely competitive, aggressive vibe where everything is a competition and who's better than who. And I remember specifically when I was interviewing for a tech accelerator program, we had to spend weeks prepping for this interview and doing practice interviews with other male founders. And the whole vibe around it, and I think this is very similar to if you're meeting with a potential venture capitalist who is most likely a man as well, they treat it in this very aggressive kind of way where, you know, it's all about who's got the highest IQ and how quickly can you answer the question and cut you off before you've had a chance to speak, and you know, you just feel like you're being in a firing range. And you know, I found that to be incredibly intimidating, especially when you're one of the only women in the room. And so for many years throughout my program at Stanford and going into starting my company, I always felt like the odd one out. A lot of times I would have an idea and people would laugh at it because it was different, or, you know, I didn't fit the norm, or I didn't look like everybody else, and they assumed that I wasn't as smart as them, or, you know, that. And I brought a different perspective because I'm very creative. And I think it took me a very long time, years later, when I finally started my company and had success and had people kind of come to me just saying how much it means to them, that how important it is to get little girls interested in engineering and tell me that my perspective was valuable. Years later, I realized that I did belong, even though I didn't, almost because I didn't fit in, that was how badly it was needed. And I realized finally for the first time, I mean, I'll say it wasn't until maybe this year, with all of the success, and buzz around my company, that I know now how valuable my perspective is. And for a long time, I got really defensive and embarrassed and ashamed and didn't feel like I was smart enough or good enough. And I almost dropped out a million times. But now I finally have the confidence to know that I do have a worthwhile perspective, and that, you know, just by being frank about it and sharing my story, hopefully all that girls and women need to do is believe in themselves and know that they belong.
So Debbie, my apologies. I meant to start with this to begin with. Tell us about your company, Goldilocks. I know that you said you want to disrupt the pink toy aisle. Tell us about that.
Well, I started my company for this very reason, that there are so few girls and women in engineering and technology, yet they're the fastest growing jobs, and they're engineers are responsible for building the world. And that's why I realized that this pipeline issue is a big one. And that leaky pipeline, I think the biggest leak is starting when you're a little kid. And girls are supposed to play with dolls and Barbie and Polly Pocket and fashion and pop stars. And boys play with Handy Manny and Bob the Builder and Lego Man. And I think that that's when our identities are born. What we think is appropriate for our gender, and that those stereotypes, you grow up with those, and it is a big hurdle to cross. So while Kimberly is doing amazing work, when they get a little bit older and they start coding, which I'll let her kind of introduce herself, but we're really focused on girls 4 to 12, creating construction sets and stories and games to teach them engineering principles and make it relevant and fun for them.
Thank you. Kimberly, Imagine, Build, Create is the motto for your company, Black Girls Code. Tell us about that.
So our organization is really focused on teaching girls ages 7 to 17 to become the builders and creators and leaders of tomorrow in technology. So as Debbie mentioned, there's really a huge issue in that. There's such a lack of representation of women and also people of color in the technology industry, and is very male dominated. So this whole bro-grammar culture really persists, which tends to keep really talented young women like Debbie from pursuing a career. And that's what we're trying to disrupt. We're trying to change the dynamic of when you think of a coder, you think of someone that looks like Mark Zuckerberg. So nothing against Mark and what he's done with Facebook, but women coders are great too, and we're trying to paint the face of the industry in one that's more female-centered, and that's the whole goal and focus of our organization. Yeah.
One of the things I've heard you say, and this really resonated with me, was imagine the impact these creative minds could have with the guidance and support others take for granted.
Yes. So when I was listening to Debbie, it was just odd because I'm quite a bit older, but I just love what she's done with Goldilocks. And it's when I meet female founders like Debbie, they're all doing these amazing creative businesses. And I see a lot of businesses. And frankly, I feel like the women founders are always better. They're like, I'm telling you they are. And they're doing things that really are going to be transformative. So I feel that Goldilocks is transformative in terms of what it can do for our girls. Another female founder that comes to mind is Aya, that is the creator of Little Bits. And that's like very transformative from a technology perspective, and putting these very tactical pieces together that teach coding and also electronics. That's transformative. So why are these women that are coming with these transformative issues and these transformative companies not getting the same focus and the same type of acknowledgement and support that men tend to get? And they just are better. I'm sorry, guys. They just like really are rocking it. And that's what I think in terms of everything that we're doing with Black Girls Code and other organizations in the field focused on girls and coding, is really giving these girls the confidence to use that creativity that they have innately and give them a little bit of technology skills as well, and just push them out there and let them change the world through code or change the world with technology, because that's what the focus on girls and telling girls they can be whatever they want to be and they can be the leaders is what's not happening today.
Debbie, I heard you say one time that you engineering it a light bulb went off with you when you realized your creative mind, you could build anything your mind could think of with engineering. That resonated with me as well.
Yeah, well, I think the word engineering the field of engineering, it has a marketing problem. It really does. Because that word, it just, to me growing up, it sounded so unappealing. And But once I finally learned that engineering is about really the way that you think, mm-hmm. it's about taking a complex problem and breaking it down into simple, manageable steps. And that kind of critical thinking is useful for all aspects of life. I think going and pursuing a STEM degree, whether you end up as an engineer or a CEO or an entrepreneur or a photographer, it doesn't matter. Those skills I found incredibly empowering in my life. They've opened up so many doors for me, and they've also changed the way that I see the world. I have, now that I kind of know the simple machines behind how everything from, you know, a website to this microphone, you know, you can't look at the world in the same way ever again, because you're constantly wondering, like, oh, how did they make this, and how does this fit together? And that's the kind of mind that I want to nurture in young kids and get them thinking that way from a young age, because then they will have the confidence when they have that idea in their head. You know, they won't be shy, and they'll be willing to take risks and try stuff and hopefully learn from failure, because that's when the biggest light bulbs go off.
Yeah. So I want to go back to that and talk about taking risk in just a second. But Renee, tell us a little bit about your background and some of the obstacles you've overcome to be incredibly successful in a male-dominated field.
So my background is a little bit different than the other panelists. I haven't founded a company. I have been with Freescale, a large corporation, for over 20 years now. Please don't repeat that to anybody. And so it's a very different path up, and I'm incredibly inspired by these women who've gone out and taken these enormous risks to get ideas off of the ground. Working within a company, I think, is a different but rewarding route. You could consider it less risky, but at the same time, within your career, even in a company, what most would consider pretty stable can be fraught with risk, and you can choose to take your own risks, particularly stepping out of a box that you're comfortable in. And that's probably one of the questions that I'm asked the most within the company as people come to me for career advice is, how did you move so much within the company? You're one of the few people we've seen that has moved across business units, who has accepted positions in different functional areas. And that is a degree of risk as well, because stepping out of something that you've grown up doing and you have direct experience in, and moving out of that box and moving laterally or up into a new area where you don't have that direct line experience can be pretty intimidating. You move out of an engineering role and into a marketing role, or out of marketing and into engineering, finance, to HR. You're putting yourself out there because you're no longer the subject matter expert. And you have to fall back almost to those engineering principles, which is problem solving. How do you take a problem and break it down into its pieces, and then use those experts that are working under you, for you, to then go tackle those problems in smaller pieces? So that's probably a good look at the risks and obstacles within a corporation. Okay. A little bit different.
So I think you're speaking to getting comfortable with being uncomfortable. It sounds like in your career you've had to get comfortable with being uncomfortable.
I'm uncomfortable a lot.
Okay, so talk.
And I'm fine with that.
So talk about getting comfortable with being uncomfortable.
So first, I wear a lot of high heel shoes. and just to remind myself that I am uncomfortable all the time, and that's okay. I don't fall down very often. I still, you know, to date have been okay with that. It's there was one point in my career that probably was incredibly impactful for me, and that was probably 5 years ago or so. I was asked one day, my boss came to me and said, you know, we have a problem. And this wasn't my area of expertise. I was in strategic marketing at the time. And my boss came in and said, we have a real issue going on in the company. We had a court order that went against us. And we are going to have to move some mountains to come into compliance with the legal findings. And we have about 4.5-5 weeks to do it. And we need some help, and we'd like you to step in. And so I said, okay. And then the next morning I woke up and he called me back in and said, bring everything you're working on because we're going to transfer it all away. And that kind of gave me the idea of the scope of what I was going to be facing. And within about 48 hours, I was presenting to our CEO and senior staff on a subject area that I knew nothing about. And jumped in with both feet and came home terrified, absolutely terrified, because I realized I knew about 25% of what I needed to know to fix this problem. I could handle the sales and marketing aspects and how to transform the processes in that side of the business. But when it came to logistics and how we move product around the world, that is an area I knew nothing about, and I was terrified. I thought for the first time, I'm going to fail, and I'm going to fail on the most visible stage I could have. And my husband, my biggest supporter, was there for me. He's a project manager, an engineer by trade. And he said, look, they picked you because you're a problem solver. You know how to fix things. They picked you because you've got the experience and the network across the corporation to go get the help that you need. So take the problem apart and go find, use your network to find the people that can move you in the direction that you need to go. And make a small decision. Make the smallest decision you can make that kind of takes you to that end goal, and then make another one 2 hours later. And that was the best advice I could get when I was staring at something that was just fundamentally overwhelming. So I went in the next day, and I made that first decision, and I started calling people and started getting advice and starting adding people to that team. And then we kept making decisions. Every hour, we'd make another one that kept moving us in that direction. Uncomfortable? Absolutely. Uncomfortable for the entire 4.5-5 week duration. But at the end, I think it was a successful project. And you learned a lot about yourself and what you could accomplish and pull through, even when you don't have the expertise.
So what you learned was you have to be uncomfortable sometimes.
Uncomfortable. Very.
So one of the things I want to key on is you said you made a very, you know, distinct line in the sand. I know about 25% of what I need to know.
Yep.
To do this project. One of the interesting things I read recently was that if you put a job description in front of a man and in front of a woman, a man will read that job description, and I think it's about 60-65%. If he has 60-65% confidence that he can do the job, he will raise his hand and say, I absolutely can do this job. A woman, on the other hand, needs a 90-95% confidence level before we'll go, I think I can do this job. How do we change that? Is it, are we our own worst enemy sometimes? Our internal voice? Kimberly?
I think so. I think and that goes back into a little bit of what Debbie was chatting about, was how girls are conditioned at a very young age to strive for perfection. And so I think we keep that with us all through our adult lives, and, you know, striving for perfection. And we don't really tell, boys don't really get those same messages. You know, there's us, go out there. They're boys. Boys will be boys. They're going to mess up. But girls, we always think, you know, we can't mess up. And I think that's one of the things that we have to try to recognize in ourselves and break, you know, and be able to take risk and, you know, be able to take a step forward, even if you don't know the second step that you're going to take after that. So one of the things I just read, that Oprah said is, you know, you're and finding your passion and moving towards it, you just need to know what's the best next step. You know, take one step and then what's the best next step. And as opposed to trying to know 10 steps down the road, this is exactly what I need to get from point A to point B. And I think as women, if we can learn to do that and challenge ourselves to do that and take that risk a little bit more, it will help us to be able to, you know, continue to drive towards the passionate things that we're about.
There's that word risk again. And Sheryl Sandberg, CEO of Facebook, said that men were more interested in newer and higher and riskier opportunities where the risks were great but the rewards even greater. And women have a high tendency to put a higher value on stability. Debbie, I know you took risk getting your Goldilocks off the ground. So talk to us about embracing that risk.
You know, I will say that risk-taking starts to become pretty addictive. But you have to take that, you have to be willing to take that first one. And I am definitely that little girl that grew up with those perfect princess role models. And I've been so hard on myself for so many years. My first big risk was choosing to major in engineering because I watched my perfect little 4.0 GPA slowly start to drop. It did not come naturally to me. It was not easy for me like all the other subjects. But I was excited by it because it was challenging. And when I did work all night long on that problem set or that coding project that I just, you know, could not seem to get, when I finally did get it, you know, those are the moments that you just know that you can really achieve greatness. And I've started to do that in my life because I find that feeling when you've kind of climbed that mountain and you get to the top and you didn't think you could get there, but you kept going and you kept going. That's when you really feel like you can do anything. And you become willing to take more and more risks because you tried one. And even if you didn't hit, even if you didn't get to the top of the mountain, you know, you didn't die. You probably learned something. You definitely learned something. And as long as you, you know, are willing to keep kind of pushing yourself, you'd be surprised when you think you're just not going to get it. Push a little bit further, and you probably will. Mm-hmm. And that feeling, there's nothing like that feeling.
So kind of along those lines of risk and being out on the edge, do you think that women sometimes sacrifice their ability to rise up because they like that, they want to be nice? I read this study the other day where little girls were asked about being bosses, and some of their typical responses were they didn't want to be a boss because to be a boss you had to be mean. So what do you guys think about that? Do we sacrifice being nice and being liked for being more successful?
I think we have a real problem in our media and pop culture around the kind of images that we put in front of little girls. If you look at children's toys and characters, it is this perfect princess or beauty queen that's always being nice and polite and you know, saying the right thing and, you know, not getting messy or getting into trouble. And, you know, boys, on the other hand, have all of these characters that are rambunctious and mischievous and create trouble, and that's okay. And like Kimberly said, you know, boys will be boys. We need girls to feel comfortable getting messy and screwing up and knowing that that's okay. It's okay to fail and not be perfect, because you can't succeed in life if you are not willing to take risks and learn from failure, period. Otherwise, you end up in this safe zone where, you know, you're going along and you're not trying to hurt anybody's feelings, but you're not achieving your potential. And maybe you kind of start to feel like you're in a rut and you could do more, but you're too afraid.
I think I would add to that. I think one of the things that we definitely have to confront as women in business or women in doing whatever our passions and careers are is that women and men are judged differently in how they work and operate in the world. So this is in like any industry, from tech, media, you know, politics, you name it. You put a woman there, you put a man, same personality traits, they are viewed differently. So I think one of the things for me that was always frustrating throughout my engineering career is that I was surrounded by these men that would, you know, have these heated arguments and throw things against the wall and all kinds of crazy things in their office. And I would be like, wow, they're like getting really into it over there. But I knew all along that I could never do that. You know, I could never have one of those days, even though I wanted to, when I could just go in my office and, you know, say 10, you know, things, profound words, and just like go crazy in my office, because I would be viewed differently as a woman in leadership. And so we have to understand that is how the game is played, but I think it's also very important to be true to yourself. So I think one of the main reasons I wanted to get out of corporate America, because I felt it was confining for me and I could not be my best self in that type of constraint. And I really saw that, you know, going back to taking the risk, it was a tremendous risk to step out on faith and start a company of my own. I didn't think it would be a nonprofit company, but I did know that it would be a company of my own. But I've just seen so much more success than I ever achieved in that corporate box, because now I can be my unique best self. And I almost, and it's probably age as well, I'm just like, hey, this is what I am. This is what you're going to get. And, you know, you just kind of get to the point where you have to say, this is how I can be the best person that I can be and drive towards my goal and be comfortable with whatever the good and the bad that may come with it. You know what I'm saying? like I'm having a little conversation. Yeah, that's what you have to do.
Yeah, I just to piggyback off that, because for years, you know, in my engineering classes and now, you know, being kind of a woman in tech, you know, there is that tendency to start kind of behaving like those around you or what you think you're supposed to be like. And so on the one hand, you think you're supposed to be more aggressive so that you can, you know, fit into, mm-hmm. you know, the whole programmer vibe. And I've played that role. And it ends up turning me into kind of this psycho angry person where I get like really defensive and start fights, which I have done. And I don't like that. I don't like that. I don't like being that. That's not who I am. And then on the other side, I've read all of these studies of, you know, women and men leaders, they are judged differently. And when you poll people, they want their men leaders to be aggressive and strategic, and they mm-hmm. want their women leaders to be, you know, nurturing and lift others up. And it's really hard to be all of those things. And there's so much pressure, especially I think as a woman leader, to try and fill all of these roles. And at the end of the day, I've tried everything. And as Kimberly pointed out, all you can really be is yourself. Mm-hmm. That's all you can be. And it might not fit that mold of perfection, but just like me as a little girl striving for perfection, I found that in recent years as well in leadership, I've been striving for this perfect thing that is just unattainable. So I'm just trying to be myself and improve every day and get feedback and get coaching and learn. But, you know, the more that I just embrace who I am and be myself and be vulnerable and be honest about my strengths and weaknesses with my team and with the world, you know, it creates really genuine connections with people. And that inspires people. So, you know, that's at that. And I've tried them all. But really just being yourself and being proud of who you are, that's really the key. And when you are yourself and you don't try to be like everybody else, that makes you unique. And those are the people that end up really changing the world, those kind of unique people that are breaking those molds.
Well, and I think you're talking about finding your unique voice and being the unique voice in the room and embracing being yourself. That sounds easy, but it's really hard to do, especially, we talked about earlier, women are leaving for three reasons, and one of those is biased evaluations where words like abrasive and aggressive are used in a woman's evaluation, but don't show up in a man. Debbie, you used the word failure. So I'd like for each of you guys to talk about a flat out failure where you fell flat on your face and how you got up from it, and what you learned from it.
Anybody have one?
Plenty. Well, okay, I have one. I have to think a little bit. Not that I don't have them, but I'm going to think about one that I want to remember. I would say, piggybacking again on something Debbie mentioned, when I went to was going through engineering school, for me it was like extremely difficult. I came from a gifted program in high school, and I had, you know, more than a 4.0 GPA when I went to college, which quickly changed when I took freshman chemistry and all the other entry-level engineering classes, and I saw my GPA plummet. I mean, like, plummet to the point I almost lost my scholarship. I really didn't know if it was for me, plummet, in terms of just barely being able to even register a GPA. It was really a bad period for me. And I did a lot of self-reflection during that time, and I think the thing that got me through is that I realized that on this journey in college that I couldn't do it alone. So I was used to studying alone. I was used to getting my work done alone. But that worked in high school. That did not work in college. I had to go outside my bubble and find people that would help me learn how to study for engineering, because it was different. And I think that was really an analogy for life, is that recognizing that I don't have to do everything. We talked about in our panel earlier today, we don't have to do everything alone. There will be people, if you say, I need this, I don't understand how to do this, or this is not my expertise, and being vulnerable enough to say, I don't know this, I don't know something, can you help me? Or can you help me learn this new tool? Or what, can you show me someone that I can talk to in this field? Being able to ask for help was what turned things around for me. You know, that really allowed me to see the bonds that I was not making in my classmates, the bonds that I was not making in my professors, that allowed me to change that. Like, what, it took me a while. It was hard work as well. I had to really, like, do nothing but study for, like, at least a good semester and a half. But was able to, by the time I graduated, I was on the dean's list, like, consecutive times. But that's from going from that, from a 1.3 or 4 or 5. I'm telling you, it was bad. The records show. But, you know, it's just having that mindset to be comfortable with asking for help and then putting my nose to the grindstone to make the difference and make the change.
So asking for help is not failure.
No, it is not.
And I think as women, sometimes we have a hard time doing that, mm-hmm. don't we? Debbie?
Yeah, you know, okay, I hate to give the exact same advice, but, you know, I'll share a story. Actually, last year, we found out the big news that Toys R Us wanted to carry Goldieblocks nationwide. And this was an amazing accomplishment for us because just 6 months prior, you know, Goldieblocks was a prototype I'd made in my living room that, you know, I'd launched on Kickstarter. With this dream of one day disrupting the pink aisle. And when we found out Toys R Us wanted to bring it on, I mean, this does not sound like a failure. This sounds like the biggest achievement imaginable. But the problem was when we started shipping it out to Toys R Us across the country, it wasn't selling. So we had, you know, in the public eye, you know, we were so successful and everything's great and we've made it to Toys R Us, but compared to all of the big, huge toy brands, you know, still nobody had heard of us. So I remember feeling this really strange kind of, you know, it was a failure, but at the same time, this huge success, and how do you deal with that? And we did the exact same thing. We asked for help, and we looked at, well, what are our assets? What do we have? And with our team, we had the ability to make really great videos, and that had gotten us success so far. And we had 5,000 Kickstarter backers who believed in us and who invested in us to make us a reality. So we reached out to the Kickstarter backers and we asked them to help us. And we said specifically, here's what you can do. We're going to film a video because we're good at making videos. We're going to film it in Toys R Us and bring your daughters. We're going to, you know, run them through and literally disrupt the pink aisle. And we didn't have permission, but we had this whole large group of girls, and the manager at Toys R Us was so befuddled, he didn't know what to do. we lied and we said we were a girls, we were the Lovelace girls group. And he actually, we thought we were, there were security guards and, you know, we thought we were going to get taken away by the police. And instead he said, oh, I wish you told me you were coming. I don't know if I have enough gift bags. So we ended up getting welcomed in and shot this video of these girls kind of breaking through and disrupting the pink aisle. And we put it up online and it got over 1 million views. And suddenly people heard about us and they knew we were at Toys R Us and Forbes picked it up and suddenly the toy started selling off the shelves. And it was this really grassroots thing, but, you know, we just got creative and we did what we could and we figured out what our strengths were and we relied on our community. And we just, not only did we ask them for help, but we gave them something really specific that they could do. Mm-hmm. And you know, we're in the similar position now, actually, even though, we've had a Super Bowl commercial and we've had all of this success. You know, this year is only our second year and, you know, we're going into the Christmas season. And again, this is a make or break time for Goldieblocks. And, you know, I think in order to be successful, you just have to put yourself out there and ask. You know, if every person in this room went and shared Goldieblocks today and spent a minute. I'm just showing you how easy it is, and you don't have to be ashamed to ask for help, because that's what does it. It's when you're a small entrepreneur, small company just starting out, that's how you do it. It is, you know, person to person, mom to mom, engineer to engineer.
Depending on your community. I love that. I love that. Renee?
So following Debbie is really hard. My story is similar. It is about asking for help. So probably one of my biggest failures personally was in college. I went to get a job, student job on campus, and I was in the computer science department. And so the job that was handed to me was in the computer department. And I walked in on the first day, and they gave me an assignment to write something around a TCP/IP stack. And I didn't know what a TCP/IP stack was. I didn't know what to do. And they handed me my assignment and left. And they left me in a lab. And there was no one there. And I came to work every day for about 5 days. And there was somebody would be there when I walked in, and they'd punch out. And there was nobody to ask questions of. No guidance. I got some books. I read about TCP/IP. I sat around and tried to do a little bit of coding that I knew how to do and realized that I was in so far over my head and was so panicked and so afraid that somebody would find out that I wasn't a very good computer science person that by Friday I quit. And I walked down the street and I got a job as a bartender, which was a fantastic job, by the way. And probably a better college job at the time. But I was faced with it again. So I quit, and I was disappointed in myself for doing that. But I didn't know how to get the help that I needed to be successful in that job. And it was probably very simple. There was probably something they could have ripped out of a manual and said, go do this, and you're going to need to solve these two or three problems. But I didn't know how to ask for that help. So 2 years later, I graduate and go out into the great big world, and I get a job at Motorola, and I'm an applications engineer, and I sit down, and my first boss tells me, here, write a printer driver for this chip. And it just flashback. You know, I got kind of sick because I thought, oh, God, I don't know how to write a printer driver. I don't know what a printer driver is. I know what a driver is, but I don't know a printer driver, and I don't know how to code it, and I don't know what to do, and now what am I going to do? Because if I quit, I'm not in college anymore, and I don't know that bartending is going to be an acceptable alternative. So this time I only sat there for like 2 days and read, you know, maybe three books all night before I went back and found one of the engineers that sat a couple of cubicles down and kind of went over there, hat in hand a little bit, to say, I have an assignment and I don't know how to do it. And could you maybe spend a few minutes of your day helping me get going? You know, if you can just give me some pointers. And that same person came by and checked on me, you know, every hour for about a week to make sure that I was making progress and, you know, getting things done in that manner, and learning to ask for that help was probably the biggest lesson that I could have taken out of that experience.
So I think that kind of goes back to support, having someone to support you, reaching out, asking for community support.
It plays right through, because today that it allows me to take risk. You know, I can take an assignment that I don't know that I'm qualified for. The statistic that you came across, or the reading about men feeling qualified knowing 50% and women needing to be 90%, really struck home with me. And I realized from the experience that I related earlier, you don't have to know everything, but you're going to have to be able to ask for that help.
Right.
And those two experiences have really allowed me to go out and take more risks, to be able to say, I'm going to try that. I know enough. I know enough to get going. And then who's that right person that's going to be, who in my network can I reach out to and ask, how do I do this?
And I think that's for women in the STEM-related fields, encouragement and support is very important. All of you have talked about, just in this round of questioning, about the support that you got, your community support, the support, Kimberly, that you reached out for, Renee, your engineering support. So So how can we encourage others to support the women out there so they can reach their full potential? How can we encourage women to be comfortable reaching out for help?
Well, I know that many women are social creatures, and I for one, am a very social creature. And I think a lot of times with engineering and STEM fields, the way right now in our current education system and how a lot of companies are set up, because it's so male-dominated, a lot of times it's positioned in this way where you have to figure it all out yourself, and that it's this genius competition. And, you know, there's nothing worse when you have difficult material and you're a social creature sitting there with books trying to solve everything on your own. So I think really creating kind of support groups, and it can be men and women. In fact, I had a support group of two classmates, one male and one female, and that's what got me through my program. One thing that I would recommend is, and I'm glad to see some men in this room, but, you know, I think that it's bringing the men in and letting them know about our experience, because those men who are maybe interviewing women who don't know that women who are overqualified are going to undervalue themselves, if they knew that, they might kind of probe or think differently about candidates. And kind of going out there and really understanding that if you're a social creature, you don't have to torture yourself and do everything on your own, really creating those support groups.
How about mentors? Kimberly?
I definitely think that mentors are definitely very important, but I also think that having sponsors is equally, if not more so, important for women, especially as you're climbing through the ranks, and there is a difference. So I often say that mentors, you know, they can be up and down. They could be a peer. They could be someone that's a level above you. They could even be someone that's a level below you. But those are the folks that you're really there to tell your story to get advice from, to bounce ideas off of. But a sponsor's role is very different. That sponsor is there to sort of pull you up and push you out into new opportunities. And I think that that can be a male or a female. It doesn't have to be a female sponsor. But this is a person that could be, I like to say, it's someone that can stand in places for you that you can't stand in yourself. And they're very important. So I think we spend a lot of time talking about mentors when we're talking to women about leadership and careers, but we should also, you know, make it very clear that really having strong sponsors in your corner is equally, if not more so, important, especially throughout your career.
And I'll just add to that, because I've had my fair share of mentors and sponsors. You really need to put yourself out there and talk to as many people as possible, because you can literally talk to maybe 100 people who will have coffee and give you advice, and maybe 1 out of 100 you connect with and develop that relationship that brings it up into the sponsor level. So just don't give up. Keep talking to as many people. Find that study buddy. Find that mentor. Find that sponsor. But you've got to be willing to put yourself out there.
I think what you said is important. Being a mentor or a sponsor isn't somebody that you have lunch or coffee with. It can start that way, because you do need to try a lot of people on for size, for lack of a better phrase. But then to sustain it and to have that mentorship or that sponsorship be meaningful, it's not a lunch conversation. It's not just probing questions. For me, I've had some people that have been extremely good sponsors in my corner who've really helped me with my career. And you have to nurture that relationship, and it's, like I said, it's not coffee. It's going to them. Once you've established that relationship and that trust, take them proposals, take them solutions, and let them critique you. Make it a working relationship rather than a casual conversation for that sponsorship to really mean something.
Right. Thank you.
You know, just add one quick thing.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
And when you get in the relationship as a mentor and you're a mentee, please be open to being coachable. So I have lots of young women that work in our organization, and this is one thing I always try to remind them. Please, you know, you have to be coachable. You have to listen to the advice, and you have to be willing to accept that you may not know all the answers already. And that's the role of the mentor or sponsor, is to help you to find the answers, not to tell you what to do, but to help you find it. So the key is to be coachable to that advice so that you can take it and mold it to what you need.
Thank you. I think we will end on that excellent advice from each of our panelists. And are we going to open it up for questions?
No,
we are done. So please thank our panelists.